الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وبعد كيف نقصنا أصول الفقه. طيب what did we leave off last time? نعم طيب one brother after the lecture last time he said that the lecture was a little bit confusing as were some of the others. He said the other two before them were also confusing.
What's the first letter of his
name? Muhammad Abu Abdullah Zayed Al Janubi. You didn't understand because you were sleeping? You didn't. MashaAllah. So, have any questions about what we did last time? You have big questions.
If you want, I can give you an objection على طريقة العرض
حق الإمام الشافعي. Okay. We have something new here.
No.
Mr. Mayor.
No, because when you listed what he said, I think it was better if we took these things as we proceed.
Oh, we will.
And discuss them.
We will. Right now we're studying the history of Usul
Fiqh. So we're still in the history.
Yes, yes. We're still in the first part of the reading, this year. Introduction, meaning of Usul Fiqh and the history of Usul Fiqh. Okay, there's two questions. I have two questions for you. And they are actually good for PhD prelims in Usul Fiqh. Good questions. Because this stuff that I covered yesterday, actually you'll not find it in very many books about Usul Fiqh. And what was Imam Shafi's... What was he really trying to say? So the first question was Imam Shafi'i, was he an innovator? Everyone know what innovator is?
Mubtada.
No. Mubtada. MashaAllah. The second wave of the land forces arrived. Wait, let's start over. The question. This is good, as I said, for a prelim in Usul Fiqh.
Come on.
Ready? You're going to have to edit this one, Mustafa. No. It's coming, don't worry. It's not with me anyway. Knife is in the chair. But was an Imam Shafi'i Mubtada? Was he bringing something new? This is a very important aspect of his teachings. And this is very important to understand what Imam Shafi'i was doing. And was he saying to the people of Iraq and to the Medinese, to the people of Medina, was he saying that the way you people are doing it is wrong, and here's the right way to do it, and he came up with the right way to do it? Is that what he did?
Well, in a way, yes.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, because he might not have brought something totally new, but he refuted some of the positions of what they are saying.
Okay. Refuted them by what?
By stating what was the original teaching of Rasulullah.
Okay. Yani, this is the important point with respect to Imam Shafi'i. Yani, the usul al-fiqh, or the understanding of the sharia, is similar to, for example, the science of aqidah. There is a correct usul al-fiqh. That correct usul al-fiqh is the usul al-fiqh as stated in the Quran and in the teachings of the sunnah, as the Prophet ﷺ brought the sahaba up in that way. That is the correct usul al-fiqh. So that's why yesterday, last time, I said that Imam Shafi'i is a mujaddid. Mujaddid, as I said, is someone, or he's called a mujaddid. And tajdid, there's three principles of tajdid. And if something existed, it was lost, and you return it back to its original state. Okay, and that's what he did with respect to usul al-fiqh. He always brought proofs, and from the Quran and from the Hadith and from the practices, especially of the Khulafa al-Rashidun, okay, Abu Bakr wa Umar. So what he was trying to do, he was not bringing something new, but he was seeing how the people had strayed in the realm of fiqh, from the correct yani fiqh and usul al-fiqh, and he tried to bring them back to the correct usul al-fiqh. So that's the first question. Second question, and can we say that he was a type of revolution, or was he the result? Was he the result of a process of evolution?
I think it's the latter one.
Pardon?
It's the latter one.
The latter one, evolution. Okay. What's your evidence for that?
My evidence for that is he studied in Mecca, and he took the knowledge of the ulama of Mecca, and he studied in Medina, and he took the knowledge of ulama of Medina, and he went to Iraq and studied with the ulama of Iraq, and he took the knowledge out of these two people and saw where everyone had shortcomings, and he filled the gap.
But in order for it to be an evolution, was there a movement towards what he was saying in the end? When we say evolution, in other words, these ideas were existing, they existed, and they were developing, and he kind of put the final touch on them. Would you say that?
I'm not sure about the term.
I think when you have a question with some of the current at that time, so we can say that this understanding is already there, but it's not. You cannot say that it is really
okay.
Not articulated.
Okay, if we look at that time, we have the scholars in Medina, which is basically the Maliki school, and we have the scholars in Syria. Basically, what school was well known in Syria? We have no Syrians in the class. Al-Awza'i. His madhab was the dominant madhab in Syria. And in Iraq we have the Kufans. I guess the Kufians, I mean. Which is kind of like the type of hat you wear, Kufi. This is the school of Abu Hanifa and his people. Okay? And if you study the different schools from a later usul al-fiqh point of view, you see that these two here rather simplistic.
Okay.
And the Kufans were developing usul al-fiqh much more than the people in these areas. For example, with respect to the Sunnah, okay. The idea that the Sunnah is known through the Hadith of the Prophet ﷺ, which is what something that Imam Shafi'i stressed, the idea that the Sunnah is known through the Hadith and not through the practices of a people, yani the customs of a people, this idea first began actually in Iraq among the Kufans or Kufians. Also the idea that ijma' is not something local, this idea also developed among the Kufans. And also, although they were known as Ahl al-Ra'i, or perhaps because they were Ahl al-Ra'i, the science of qiyas or analogy, by the way you remember these terms, ijma' is consensus and qiyas is analogy, the science of analogy was much more developed among the Kufians than it was among the other. Yeah. What was one of the points that Imam Shafi'i was trying to make about qiyas? Okay, there has to be strong resemblance, and it's not just a matter of mustaha or looking at the situation and seeing what looks best to you, but there has to be strong resemblance between the parallel case and the original case. Okay. And Imam Shafi, any qiyas or ra'i, before Imam Shafi's time, in many areas, it was the case that you make qiyas on a very general basis. And not something specific that this is the illah or this is the hukum or this is the ruling or the cause of the ruling in this case and this is the parallel case. But in general, you make qiyas on the basis of maslaha, and that this principle is supported here, so therefore we'll support it over here. Imam Shafi tried to restrict it and say if you want to make qiyas or you want to make analogy, there has to be a strong resemblance between the parallel case or the new case and the original case. Now all three of these began to develop actually in Kufa or in Iraq, and it seems as Ahmed pointed out that Imam Shafi'i he benefited greatly from his debates with the Iraqis, although at the same time he still refuted many of their views. But they did not have anyone who put these new principles. In other words, it was still somewhat haphazard, as I used the word last time. I'll use chaotic now. Okay. It was still somewhat chaotic. In other words, some of these ideas developed and some of them applied these ideas while some people were still following the old ideas. So it took until Imam Shafi wrote Risala and also his other works where he really laid down and put down clearly for everyone to understand how the principles of Usul al-Fiqh are to be used. So it was a kind of evolution, but as I said earlier, it is kind of it's more of a reversion than an evolution. Reversion. Because as I said, this was actually, Imam Shafi's principles were basically based on the principles of the Sahaba, especially the Khulafa, Abu Bakr and Umar. Okay. So we had, and some of the principles that were existing during the time of the Sahaba, they were somewhat lost for many reasons, and they begin to be redeveloped and they finally finalized by Imam Shafi. Any questions about that? The Egyptian school wasn't much of a school. Alayth bin Sa'd was the major proponent of the Egyptian school, but when Imam Shafi moved to Egypt, and it was a rather weak school, and he kind of destroyed that school. I mean, there's many other schools, obviously, but these are some of the better known.
So, I have heard of the schools that have been developed,
not in the same fashion as the Imam Shafi. Okay, Imam. Chaotic? And without organization, without it wasn't systematic. Pardon me? Now, what I was saying is that these ideas developed, but at the same time, the situation was still such that some people followed these ideas while some were still following the other ideas, even in Iraq itself. Imam Shafi, because of his writing, he kind of, have to be a little bit tentative, but he kind of put an end to all that. The reason why it was chaotic is because there was no like source book that everyone agreed on that they could go to. Now Imam Shafi, he said basically, there's four sources for the Sharia. And these four, among the people known as Ahl al-Sunnah wa Jama'ah, there's no difference of opinion about them. These four are what, obviously? Quran, Sunnah. Ijma'ah. And? Qiyas, which is his, what he called Ijtihad. Okay. I must be really moving much too fast here. Yes.
Imam Shafi wrote anything about how
And in Kitab al-Umm, al-Umm is basically Shafi's book of fiqh.
Okay.
Now, one thing about Imam Shafi is that, this what he was writing was not actually something theoretical, but these were the guidelines for his own madhab, and he applied these principles in Kitab al-Umm. And the principles that he wrote about in al-Risala, you can find them discussed in, and you can find them implemented. These were not just theoretical things, but he was implementing these principles in his book Kitab al-Umm. In Kitab al-Umm, he discussed the different topics, which would also include the topic you asked about.
Can we extract the sense from Abu Hanifa?
Okay, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. Now, Abu Zahra writes in his book about Imam Shafi, which is on reserve in the library. Yeah, the sign is there saying these books are on reserve.
What
does that mean? Means you read them in the library, you don't take them out of the library, so everyone else can benefit from it. Like what you did. Abu Zahra says that after the time of Imam Shafi, the scholars are split into three groups. Okay. I'm going to tell you what he said and then discuss it. After Imam Shafi wrote the Risala, he said the scholars of fiqh can now be divided into three groups. Three. Let's make it four. He said three. Yani fuqaha. Okay. Number one are those who accepted what? Avon? Huh? Yani schools of thought. Well, not schools of thought. Look, I tell you what, we'll go through it first and then we'll decide what to call it. Those who accepted what Shafi wrote in general, okay, but had some differences, okay, with respect to details. Okay. In other words, they accepted these four, but exactly how to apply them, they had some minor differences. And Abu Zahra says these are the Hanafis. Okay. Abu Zahra said these people are the Hanafis. Okay. Number two, he said those who accepted the majority, now obviously actually there's no way you can avoid accepting the majority of what Imam Shafi wrote, because the first part of it is about Zayan and Loga, language, and the principles of language and how to understand the Quran based on language, and then the position of the Quran, the position of the Sunnah. And in general, as I said, he's not bringing something new, and it's very hard to reject what he's saying. So those who accepted the majority of what Shafi wrote, but they had some major differences with them. With respect to the sources of the Sharia.
When you say those who accepted, do you mean accepted Risala or
Risala? Risala. With him. The major differences. So under this he puts the Malikis and the Hanbalis. Okay. Let me just make sure I'm getting what he wrote wrong. After I write it, I'll refute what he said, by the way. Okay. The third, that's why I said actually it's four groups. Some completely rejected some of his basic pillars, and the pillars of his theory. Some completely rejected. It's mahdoof, yani it is understood. Some completely rejected some of his basic pillars. For example, a group of Mu'tazila, the followers of a scholar by the name of An-Nabam, I have to write it in English. Okay, the followers of Nabam, for example, they rejected qiyas. Okay. They rejected qiyas as a source of shariah. When we get to qiyas, we can discuss that. Okay, also the group known as Zahiri. Yeah. Next year. They also rejected qiyas. Now this madhab, named or founded by Dawood al-Zahiri, and Dawood al-Zahiri is different from Ibn Hazm. See? Ibn Hazm rejected all kinds of qiyas. Dawood al-Zahiri did not. But he rejected many types of qiyas. He accepted only the type of qiyas which is known as the clear qiyas al-jalli. And the clear manifest qiyas. He used to be a follower of the Shafi'i madhab, and then he rejected qiyas, and someone asked him, why are you rejecting qiyas? And he said that the Imam Shafi'i has a book called Ibtal al-Istihsan, where he refutes using istihsan. Dawood al-Zahiri said, I read this book by Imam Shafi'i, and I found that all the arguments apply to qiyas also, so I'm also rejecting qiyas. Okay. The Shia, in general, they reject qiyas. Okay. Shia. Yani, as a group with a separate usul, they are the same Shia and Rafida. They reject qiyas. They only accept Sunnah. Or they only accept Hadith from. From whom? From Ahlul Bayt, from the people of the Prophet's family. They will not accept hadith from someone outside the Prophet's family. And they also have another source of law. Their source of law is the Imam statements. Okay. The Imam statements are equal to the Sunnah. In fact, if you read the Surah Al-Kahfi, the Imam statements are superior to the Sunnah. Because the Prophet was to be followed by the Imams, so he could say something and incorrect, but after the last Imam there's no one, so he has to make it final.
No.
The Imams, there are 12 Imams. Basically I'm talking about the 12, what they're known as the 12 or Shia or the Ja'fari. And the Abadi, they rejected Ijma' of the Muslim Ummah, or they did not consider the Ijma of the Muslim Ummah. And the fourth, going back to this one now, the fourth one, pardon? The fourth group are basically the followers of Imam Shafi'i. who took our Risala and they explained it and they commented on and they, you know, filled some gaps. Imam Shafi'i did not discuss everything in the Risala, and they took up some of the things that he, and basically the followers of Imam Shafi'i is the fourth group. No, the Hanafis? Definitely not. No question that they are not the same. And basically they explain a Risala, improved a little bit on some of the arguments, but they differed with him in many of the details. Okay? Pardon? The Hanafis. I was pointing, you didn't see me, I was pointing, I said they differed. This is part of three. These are all under three over here.
Mm-hmm.
Some groups of Mu'tazila, as I said, they didn't reject the Sunnah as a source of law, but they said yani, they don't accept Hadith.
These came later or at the same time?
No, same time. Yani, Imam Shafi debated with them quite a bit. Okay. This is, as I said, this is Abu Zahra's. Here we are. Abu Zahra's categories, okay, or divisions of the people who came after Imam Shafi. Said you can put them into one of four groups. It's very strange. Very strange. And it's because the people who differ the most from the Shafi'is are the Hanafis. Okay. These are the people who differ the most. So, and actually what happened after Imam Shafi, as I said, everyone accepted these four. But basically some of the madhab, they weren't satisfied with just these four. And they added some that Imam Shafi left out. So for example, the Malikis. Okay. This is the correct thing now, I'm refuting what he said. Malikis accepted in general what he said. Their madhab is much closer to the Shafi madhab than the Hanafi madhab. As we'll see in this class. When we talk about difference of opinion in Usul al-Fiqh, it's usually between the Jamhur, which is everybody else, and the Hanafis. Okay? So the Turkish brothers. So the Malikis, they added the practices of the people of Medina. Okay?
Nowadays,
no, not nowadays. That was Imam al-Haramain, one of his arguments. He said, if anyone goes to Medina nowadays, he'll know that Amal Ahl Medina doesn't mean anything. Yeah.
Did you say that Hanafi Jalal went to diverting mosque?
From Shafi Madhab, yeah. Oh, okay, except for these. Okay, I'm sorry, except for these, of course. I'm talking about of the four Madhab. Okay, just give me time. They had differences, not really here, okay? They pretty much accepted these things, but they added something. Like practices of Medina, something called Salah Mursala. If you don't know what the term means right now, it's okay. We're not trying to get the meaning of the term, we're just trying to show that Malikis, they added some. And basically they accepted these things. They have no problem with these four. Some of the people who wrote commentaries on Ar-Risala are from the Maliki Madhab. Okay. But it's not sufficient. And it is more than these four. And in fact, even some Shafi'i scholars, they said the same. Okay. The same thing with the Hanbalis. Hanbalis, in fact, the Hanbalis, they have a little difference. They don't really accept this order. Besides strongly downing Ijma' as I referred to last time, except for the Ijma' of the Sahaba, they have a tendency to put something in here before Qiyas, which is what? Pardon? Okay. The statements of the Sahaba is very important in their madhab. In general, Maliki's also added something called Salat al-Zara'i. The principle where if something leads to wrong, if something leads to something wrong, then it's also forbidden. Okay, this principle. The Hanbalis also use that quite a bit. But no, I am here. Yeah, that's right. You Saudis know about this principle. It's still alive. And they also use istishab. Okay, they also added that. Istishab. Istishab. Well, this is the presumption of continuity, right, Abu Saud? Presumption of continuity. Yani, no.
Example.
It's misspelled in the outline, in the. Sorry. Gee, I don't know why WordPerfect spelling check didn't catch that one. Okay. Now the Hanafis though are a different case. Okay, the Hanafis, as we'll see in this class, besides adding things like istihsan, which we talked about last time. Now that's istishab. Now we're talking about istishan. Istishab is that, for example, if something is halal, and we know it's halal, and we don't have any proof that it's become haram, then we say it is still halal. For example. For example, if we know that you're married, and we have no evidence that you divorced your wife, then we rule that you're still married to your wife. That kind of thing. Istisan, as I said last time, according to Imam Shafi, is where you just sit and say, this is nice, I like this. Okay. They also included statements of the Sahaba. But more importantly, with respect to the Hanafis, is that in many of these things, they differ from the rest. Okay, so his statement is very strange. Abu Zahra. Abu Zahra, by the way, was from the Hanafi madhab, and I don't know how he could make this statement. Any questions?
So all of these people
accepted but added something. And accepted in general. As I said, it's very hard to refute what he wrote. Maybe some minor details. Except for with these people. As I said, here basically there's no difference in the interpretation of these things among the Malikis and the Hanbalis and Shafis. But here we're going to see a big difference. And we're going to get to why in a second. See a big difference between these people and the rest in interpreting these things. No, he's wrong. He said there's only minor differences with respect to details. That's not right.
So what you're saying is that everybody basically agrees on the kashas, but the interpretation varies from one another.
No, the interpretation just varies really among the Hanafis and the rest. The rest, the concept, the interpretation is correct, but they just said that there are also some other sources. And as I said, even some of the Shafis, they had other sources themselves. That's one thing about usul al-fiqh, especially in this, and it is not when the door to ijtihad was closed, as they say, so it was not closed in Usul al-Fiqh. And the best works on Usul al-Fiqh came during the time when the so-called door to ijtihad was closed. Come on, Ali.
Did Abu Zahra take the investigation during the Shafi'i
time? No, Abu Zahra died a little while ago. This is in a book called Imam al-Shafi'i.
Well, it's good to make a clarification.
Yes, but unfortunately he's dead now. We cannot tell him that he was wrong.
What about those additions? Were they also made during Al-Shafi?
Yeah, yeah. These are the scholars' reaction to our Risala. Okay, we accept what you said, but, and we add some things here, and here, there's a big difference. And we'll get to, right now we'll get to see why there was such a big difference. They have, but it's not as important as it is in the Maliki Madhab. So the Zara'i plays a big role.
What's
the difference between those four and the Kabir? Are they the same? You keep going back and forth. Sometimes
they say they accept those four, sometimes they say they accept the other.
And these people, basically, well, these four, in other words, these are the teachings of Risala. So the only thing is, Hanafis, even when it comes to these things, they have lots of differences. And that's what we're going to get to. Okay? Well, any question about this?
Last question, but when you get through that.
Oh, you mean the actual meanings of these things? Yeah, don't worry about that now. Okay? Don't worry about actually what this means right now, except in general. Although this one I didn't even define. It's too difficult. Okay. Now we'll see why these differences came up. Why the Hanafis are so different from the rest. Okay? That is, if there's no more questions about it.
Now the focus will be hitting those groups out and discussing the differences between Hanafi and Qadariya.
Yeah, here in this class we're not concerned with any of these until the end of the class when we talk about the difference. Madhab will talk about this one and this one, and maybe this one. They don't have very many references on the Abadi Madhab, so I cannot really talk. Also from Libya you can get their work. Yes, pretty much. No. Okay, well, as I said, we're going to see now what's the big difference and why these differences arose, and what's the problem with them, and how even if we want to be really extremist, we can even say that there's no such thing as a Hanafi madhab, but we wouldn't want to say that. But after the time of Imam Shafi'i, and when he wrote basically the first book, the first textbook on Usul al-Fiqh, the people who came after him and wrote about Usul al-Fiqh, they can be divided into two categories. Okay? One category are called the we're finished with Abu Zahra. Now this division I'm doing here, something you'll find in every book of Sunnah, even Khalaf's book. No, even we're finished with Zerbozu. We move on now to something well known. Mutakallimun. Okay. And Fuqaha. Okay. Those who wrote, what's the category? Those who wrote after the time of Imam Shafi'i can be divided into two major categories. Mutakallimun and Fuqaha. Fuqaha, I think everyone knows, means jurists. Mutakallimun, what's a good... don't you translate it. Speakers. These are speakers of the house. Mutakallimun. Let's call them theologians. We could call them philosophers, but we want to distinguish between what became known as Islamic philosophy and what is actually ilm al-kalam. Okay, over here on this side, you're gonna like this. Theologians. Yes, that's correct. Okay, over here we have the Mu'tazila. Okay. But where we have also the Shafi's and Ash'ari. Over here we have the Hanbalis and Salafis. Over here we have the Shia. The Shia, by the way, in Ilm al-Kalam, they're very close to the Mu'tazila. Over here we have the Yazidis. Over here we have the Abadis. Oh, sorry, I left out the Malikis. Over here we have the Malikis. Hey. All these Mutakallimun. What's left? Hanafis. Okay. Who do you think wins? And the rest? Okay, what do we mean by these two divisions when we say that these are the ones who are writing Mutakallimun and these are Fuqaha? It has to do with their methodology. When you think of Ilm al-Kalam, what do you think of? philosophy. Okay. And the way these people approach the topic, okay, these people approach the topic in a theoretical way. Okay. These people approach the topic in a theoretical way. In other words, like, which is similar to a risala by Imam Shafi'i. They say, okay, what are the proofs in Islamic law? First, the Quran. What is the proof? That the Quran is the proof. How to use the Quran. They didn't deal very much with fiqh, with actual things, unless to bring examples. Okay? So this is a very theoretical approach to the topic. Okay? Everything they present here has to have logical argument based on the Quran and Sunnah. Everything they say here has to be having some logical argument behind it. The advantage of this approach is that, at least in theory, everything you say is based on Quran, Sunnah, and, as I said last time, or the first time, irrefutable logic. Okay. The problem with this approach, which kind of goes with the name, number one, they had a tendency to talk about things that really had nothing to do with Usul al-Fiqh. Okay. For example, they used to talk about before the Prophet ﷺ received his first revelation, was he ma'soom or not? They have a debate about, was he protected from committing sin before the first revelation or not? They have lengthy debate about whether if someone is given blessings from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and is it because of reason that he should give thanks for it, or is it because of revelation that says that he should give thanks for it? This kind of...
Are they all same, or do they have...
No, there's lots of things, especially here. I mean, obviously the Mu'tazila. Notice here I also put, these are Aqidah, Mu'tazila, Ashari, and Salafi. Over here I mentioned that, and obviously this is not fixed. There were some Shafi's that were Salafi, there were some Hanbalis that were Ashari, and so forth. But the reason I put them here is because in the book, since they took it from a Mutakallimun point of view, they discussed matters really of Aqidah instead of Usul al-Fiqh. So you know from their writing what... I didn't say over here, for example, what Aqidah school they're following. Another problem also is that since they're talking about logical arguments, sometimes they go into very long-winded proofs of what they wanted to say. And it even gets boring sometimes. Okay, now over here. So they're from a theoretical point of view. They said, we have the Sharia, how to make proofs from the Sharia. They go to the Quran and Sunnah. They don't go to fiqh points. They just go from the Quran, to the Quran and Sunnah and try to see what are the proofs in the Quran and Sunnah that give evidence for Usul al-Fiqh. I will give an example how these... And here we're not talking about reasoning in like Aqal point of view, but I mean reasoning from the point of view that you're starting. Here's what they're saying. Okay, they're saying Usul al-Fiqh is an independent science, and Fiqh has to submit to the rules of Usul al-Fiqh. Okay, Usul al-Fiqh is the independent science, and Fiqh has to submit to the rules of Usul al-Fiqh. Therefore, they go to the Quran and Sunnah and they try to get the rules of Usul al-Fiqh. These people developed basically, and this is not my statement, this is many authors' statements, including Abu Zahra, one of the Hanbalis. So they take the conclusions of Abu Hanifa and Muhammad al-Shaybani and Abu Yusuf, okay? They take their conclusions and they try to figure out what is the way that they argued, and on what basis did they make these conclusions. See, they're going the opposite way. Okay, they are starting with the conclusion of their imam. In other words, their fiqh, and you can really say, or their usul fiqh actually is not based on Quran, Sunnah, and Ijma. Their usul fiqh is based on their trust in their imams that they took the guidance from the Quran, Sunnah. So they start with the point and the conclusions. So for example, Abu Hanifa said something, that if you do such and such, it's haram. So they take this statement and they try to figure out, why did he say that? What was his reasoning? And when they try to figure out his reasoning, they come up with a qaida or principle, and they say, this is the Hanafi madhab. Okay? Now, Shah Wali Allah from India in the last century, who is also Hanafi, he said, he pointed out one of the greatest dangers of this approach. He said, most of the principles concerning which the Hanafis disagree with all the other madhahab, and they were never stated by Abu Hanifa, or by Abu Yusuf, or by Shibani. And in other words, these principles that they derived, they're actually not the statements of Abu Hanifa and so forth. But they were principles derived from the later scholars. Okay? I'll give you an example. I'll give you two examples. That you shall... Sure.
When you said theoretical, I mean, the first category of the sense of
all these people.
Why does it make it theoretical? What's the difference?
Because they're not starting with practice. They're not starting with fiqh. They're starting with theory. And you know the difference between theory and practice in any field.
You know also the practice. I mean, you can't just stay there and just think about the hypothetical questions. You have to have some kind of...
And if they go through the Quran and Sunnah, and they see what is, first of all, language. Okay? You don't have to know any fiqh to know language. The principles of language, right? So they don't look at fiqh. They look at the principles of language as related to usul fiqh. Secondly, they go to the Quran, they go to the Sunnah. So for example, with respect to the proof of the position of the Sunnah in Islam, they don't have to go to fiqh point of views and say that this Imam said this because he believes in this Hadith, which means he believes in the Sunnah. They just go to the Quran, and the Quran says you have to obey the Prophet. Position of the Sunnah. Okay? And as I said, they are looking at usul fiqh as something that fiqh has to abide by. They're looking at it from a completely different point of view.
But when Imam Al-Mahdi, for instance, came up with some conclusions,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure also he put how he gets the conclusion.
Yes, but
what does that mean for, I mean, for people to figure out what he meant? I mean, they didn't say that's the problem.
Yeah, because they're defending their madhab. You know, it's a big difference for Imam Shafi'i to write down what he believes in, and for someone to come along and try to look at what Abu Hanifa said and then try to figure out what Abu Hanifa believes.
Yeah, but Abu Hanifa based his argument on the Quran and Sunnah, Ijma.
Hey.
So.
Okay, look. Yeah, that's their argument. That, I will not say that they believe that the Hanafi madhab is like ma'asum, but they believe that Abu Hanifa based his argument on the Quran and Sunnah. But still, they come up with the qawaid or principles that Abu Hanifa never said. And these principles differ from all the others. And Shah Wali Allah said, these principles are not from Abu Hanifa. How can we say this is a Hanafi madhab? Well, I'll give you some examples of the way that they argue, okay? For example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, أقيم الصلاة لدلوك الشمس. Okay. نعم. أقيم الصلاة لدلوك الشمس. Okay. How do you translate دلوك? As it passes the meridian, or after it reaches the zenith. Okay. The noon prayer is to be started when the sun passes the meridian, okay? So for these people, all the scholars believe that the sabr, okay, or the forcing cause, okay? That's the best I can come up with. The forcing cause of a prayer is the time of prayer. Okay, in other words, all of them agree that if you make the prayer before the time begins, the prayer is not valid. Okay? So, and the forcing cause is the time of the prayer. Now for these people, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, لِدُلُوكَ الشَّمْسِ. Lam here is what? Okay, the lam here means it's causal. Causal. In other words, When the sun makes its duluk, you must pray. Okay, duluk means the time for prayer has begun. Okay? They have no problem with that. An interesting question, of course, which is not related to what we're doing here. Suppose, for example, that after Maghrib, the time for Isha is when all the redness disappears. Right? Suppose you're living in a place where the time between Maghrib and Fajr is too short for the redness to disappear. And amazingly, all the old fuqaha, they discussed this point in their books of fiqh. We will not discuss it here. Okay. So this says, yani, that when the prayer time begins, that is the sabab or the cause for the prayer. Now, according to these people, yani, if the time begins, then you have to pray. If there's something that keeps you from praying, for example, you lose your mind, then let's say like the Dhuhr time begins at 12:15. Okay? If Dhuhr time begins at 12:15, then as soon as it's 12:15, and you're obliged to pray Dhuhr. But if you don't pray Dhuhr and then you lose your mind, and according to these people, handle it very easily. That there's no problem with that, you don't have to make up the salat. Okay. Now the Hanafis have a statement. Okay. Let me make sure I get this right. I don't want to... Oh, okay. And these people say that in that case, if you go crazy or something, you have to make up the prayer. Because the sabab came and you were forced to pray. So the Hanafis have a narration from the Imams, whether Abu Hanif or Muhammad or Shaybani, says that if there's some... If there is some mana, something preventing you from praying, and I'm going to get in trouble with this example trying to explain that. The second example is much easier. So if there's something preventing you from praying, according to the Hanafi madhab, then, and for example, you go crazy. At 12:30, you go crazy. I know people like that. 12:30 every day, they go... Pardon me? I'm just giving it, or you faint. Okay, you pass out or something. Okay? So if there's something preventing you from praying, according to the Hanafi madhab, you do not have to make up the prayer. Okay. This is there, and this is a fiqh point. This is a fiqh point. And from this fiqh point, they're going to derive their usul. Now, what is the problem that they're facing here? No. Something more interesting, more general. Now look what they're saying. If the beginning of the time of prayer is the sabab for praying, in other words, if it's 12:15, you have to pray. Okay, if you go crazy, doesn't matter, you have to make up the prayer. But they find in their books that no, you don't have to make up the prayer. So they have a problem here. If you don't have to make up the prayer, it means that the beginning of the time actually wasn't the sabab or the cause for the prayer. And if you don't have to make up the prayer, it means that the beginning of the time was actually not the sabab for the prayer. Now let me make sure I get this correctly. Okay? So, if the beginning of the time was the sabab for the prayer, he would have to make up the prayer later. Instead of saying this is wrong, instead of saying Abu Hanifa or Shaybani was wrong, they think this is correct, and they try to figure out how to justify it.
But how did Abu Hanifa come to that conclusion?
That's what they're trying to do. That's their problem. That's why I said it's a big difference between what Imam Shafi'i did and what Abu Hanifa, what they're trying to do. So, yes. Okay. But at the same time, if you pray at 12:18, if you pray at 12:18 or you pray at 12:15, your prayer is correct. Okay, that's also a problem. Okay? Because if you pray at 12:15, let's say Dhuhr time is from 12 to 3 o'clock. 12:15 to 3 o'clock. If you pray at 12 to 12:16, your prayer is correct. That means the last part from 2:45 to 3:30 or to 3 o'clock, this could not have been the sabab for the prayer. Yeah, because if 2:45 to 3 o'clock was the sabab for the prayer, when you prayed at 12:16, your prayer is not the sabab. It's good we're in the engineering building because this is... Okay. But if you delay the prayer until 2:45, then you must pray at that time. Right? So, and because of this, instead of just saying that this principle must be wrong, they take these, yani, furor, these fiqh points, and they try to come up with yani, qaida. Okay? Yes. So they say.
No, the argument when it says, I lose his mind.
Yes, I'm listening.
Like what you have in the example, from the time of the prayer, like 15 up to 3, all of you use it for just a period from 15 up to 12.
No, that's no problem there. But he loses after 12:15 until after 3 o'clock. Okay. So therefore, here's what they have to say. This is from one of their books. And all of this so far is from one of their books in fiqh. The sabab for the prayer, and this is, and if you try to reason in this way, instead of just saying maybe this point isn't right, you have to get into some arguments which, any, well, waste of time. They say the sabab for the prayer is the first part, or the cause, the fourth and cause of the prayer, is the first part of the time of prayer, in other words, 12:16, that's it, if the prayer is actually performed during that time. Otherwise, the sababiyya or the cause changes, okay, the cause changes until, or changes till the next portion of the time, and so on. So the cause changes until, and what they're trying to prove is that if, for example, well, let's say 12:10, or, 12:16. What they're trying to prove is that at 12:16, if you go crazy, I like this example. Okay? They're trying to prove that this is not the sabab for the prayer because you haven't prayed yet. If you're still crazy at 2 o'clock, okay, and you haven't prayed yet, then they have to argue that this is still not the sabab for the prayer. And if at 3 o'clock you're still crazy, okay, then in essence they're saying there's no sabab for the prayer and that's why you don't have to make up the prayer. Okay. And it is, pardon me? Yeah, sleeping is not, no. Mana. Sleeping is not mana. Fainting. Going crazy. Okay, let me give you another example. I should have started with this again. I'm not even going to ask if this one's clear. But this will be on the final exam.
The point here is making up the
answer. Huh?
The point is making up the answer.
The point is that they have this rule. Okay? This is what one of their imams said. I'm not sure which one or where they got it from. But this is supposedly the Hanafi madhab. That if something prevents you from praying, then you do not have to make up the prayer. Okay? But what the problem is this is that if the beginning of the time of the prayer is the sabab for prayer, then you cannot say you don't have to make up the prayer. So they have to figure out some way of saying you don't have to make up the prayer. Yeah, instead of saying that, well, maybe this isn't right. This is the sabab. And in other words, this is your question, the theoreticians or the other schools, they would look at it as this, like, look, the Quran, this is the sabab. As soon as the sabab comes, it's clear that you have to pray. Forget about what Imam Shafi said. If Imam Shafi said this, and we're from this school, we'll say, forget about what he said. He's wrong. And they're not trying to defend the madhab. But the Hanafis were trying to defend the madhab. Okay.
Very close to the Ash'ari madhab when it comes to that. They're trying to give reasoning for reason, until they get out. I mean, the way they are.
I don't know. Okay, I will give you... The qaida, well, I read it. It's a long qaida. The sabab for prayer is the first part of the time of the prayer, if the prayer is actually performed during it. Otherwise, the sabab changes to the next portion of the time and so on. Until the time is just sufficient to pray. If the time passes and the person did not pray, the sabab is attributed to the entire time, and therefore the sabab, yani, he did not have the sabab, and therefore he doesn't have to pray. instant replay. Okay, here's a simpler example. Okay. Can you all read that? What did you say, Abu Saud? This says the Mushtarak doesn't swim. Is that what you said? Okay. This is the principle. It says that Mushtarak, or yani, a word that can refer to more than one thing. isn't the sort of hook fun? Now you all know, yani, about the you all know now why the Hanafis say that if you miss the prayer for some mana, you don't have to make the prayer. You can never repeat it again, but you all know the reason. Okay, so mushtarak is a word that can refer to more than one thing, actually. Now the other, for example, the Shafi'is, they say that if you have a word which is mushtarak, it can apply to more than one thing. Okay. In other words, it could apply to all of the things. Okay, the Hanafis, they say no. They base, so now I'm doing the example a little bit differently. This is now their maxim, that the mushtarak is not to be used for more than one meaning. Yeah. The mushtarak cannot be used for more than one meaning. Here, brothers. More than one meaning. In other words, okay, if there's a verse in the Quran or Hadith which is using a word which is mushtarak, can refer to more than one thing, it has to refer to just one of them according to this Hanafi madhab. Okay, that is the maxim according to the Hanafi madhab. I'll give you an example of mushtarak. Okay, I'll give you an example of mushtarak, and I'll even, it is not. In English we say homonym, but it's not exactly the same thing as mushtarak, as my definition shows. Okay. Huh? Pardon? Homonym is English, not Arabic. Yeah. Mushtarak? Mushtarak is a word that applies to more than one thing. Okay, here comes an example that's going to make everything clear. Allah. In the fiqh, the terminologies are more precise. Okay. Suppose we have person A here. And this is usul fiqh, it could be alif. Okay. I'm going to show you how the Hanafis get this qaida. Okay? We have person A. Person A is a slave. Okay? And over here, this is now B's family. B's family frees A. He's a slave. They freeze him. Bring him back after 2,000 years. Okay? They free him. Okay? What do you call now these people? Huh? Okay, they're also called Mawali. Okay? Okay, these are called Mawali. The same time A, after he's freed, he gets money. He frees some people down here, C, B, and E. Okay? Where's the neutron? going back to my high school days. Okay. These people down here are called also what? Mawali. Okay.
These people up here are known as the upper Mu'ali, and these are known as the lower Mu'ali. Everything clear? Yeah, these, no, B's family is the upper Mu'ali to A. Okay, it's a relative term. B's family are the upper Mu'ali to A, and C, D, and E are the lower Mu'ali to A. So everything is in with respect to A. These are called the upper Mu'ali, these are called the Ani. They, because Mu'ali can refer to the one who's freed as well as the one who frees. Oh, you didn't know that? Okay, sorry about that. Mu'ali refers to the one who freed and the one who is freed. Okay, everything clear so far? Okay, now, what was it? Okay, A dies and A has a will. Okay. A has a will, says, I leave so much property to my Mu'ali. Which one? This word? This word must be mushtarak, because it refers to these people and to these people. Okay? According to Abu Hanifa. Okay? Now this is the principle that they, if the person leaves the will like this, and he doesn't say which one he's referring to, then the will is void. But doesn't mean anything. Okay? So from this point, okay, he said, Abu Hanifa said, actually there's three opinions from Abu Hanifa, but we won't worry about that right now. He said that if the person did not state which Mu'ali he means, then the will is void. Okay? So that's what his statement is. We conclude from this that Imam Abu Hanifa believes that mushtarak cannot be used. Okay? Imam Shafi believes that the mushtarak can be used, yani, for more than one. So he will say, yeah, but can be applied for more than one. He will say, okay, divide it equally between them. Imam Shafi will say, divide it equally between them. No problem. Okay? Clear, huh?
Why not go to the Arabic language?
Clear as mud, as they say.
No.
It means, this is mushtarak. It refers to these people and these people. The problem is this person, A, should have put, you know, in parentheses, upper or lower. No, it means both. Yes, but the linguist is wrong. Okay, now, there's a further adjustment that they have to make. Okay, because if someone, okay, someone like A has both upper Mu'ali and lower Mu'ali, and someone says, I swear that I will not talk to his Mu'ali. Okay? I swear that I will not talk to his Mu'ali. Again, he didn't say whether he means upper or lower. Okay? If he speaks to any one of them, according to Abu Hanifa, if he speaks to any one of them, he's breaking his oath. So they have to change this to say mushtarak cannot be used for more than one meaning unless it is followed by, or it is used followed by negation, or it is used in a negative sense. I don't know. Okay, in other words, they have to add a condition here, illa, and it is used in a negative sense. No, this is what Abu Hanifa said. Abu Hanifa said this will is void. And he also said that the person who said that, I swear I will not talk to his Mu'ali, he also said that if he speaks to any of them, upper or lower, he breaks his oath. No, it's not contradiction. It's just you have to understand his reasoning. That mushtarak cannot be used for more than one meaning unless it's used in negative. That's the fuqaha approach, or the Hanafi approach to usul fiqh.
But
we apply this principle to the Quran and Sunnah. And you don't change the former. In other words, if there's a word which is mushtarak in the Quran
and it is followed by negation, then it applies to everything the mushtarak refers to. If there's a word that's mushtarak in the Quran, not in negation, then you cannot apply that verse until you define who's the mushtarak, according to the Hanafi. The other say mushtarak can be used for more than one meaning. So that's what I said in this first case. If he didn't say which muali, Imam Shafi said, okay, divide it between all of them. Refers to all of them.
So,
when is your hand is hand is up? Yes, in general he didn't say this. He didn't say this. It was the later fuqaha who derived these principles from his conclusion. Now, as I said, the problem with the Hanafi approach is that you are relying on the fact that Abu Hanifa is correct.
If Abu Hanifa came up with some ahkam and did not say how he came to that conclusion, how could people follow? How could people say he's a scholar? Reason he's a scholar, it means that he came up with some rules and say, well, here's what happens, here's why.
No, not necessarily. Not necessarily. Especially not in the early years. At all. And yes, go ahead.
So they
start
from his conclusions and then they
build the matrix. Yes, exactly. That's what I was trying to say. About what?
Can you say that they are not theoretical?
Now, this is the Hanafi approach. Some of Hanafi books on Usul al-Fiqh look more like books of Fiqh than Usul al-Fiqh. You open up Usul al-Siraqti, you'll have a hard time finding, yani, for example, where does the Quran begin, where does the Sunnah begin? There's all just Fiqh principles, and he took points and he's driving rules from them. I did. There's some mistake. And of course, I guarantee you there's some mistake. Hey, come on. Have a water. If the mistakes are clear, it's no problem. Yeah, I type it quickly as always. Just a minute, brothers, please.
It cannot be more than one.
No, Abu Hanifa said if he speaks to any of them, either upper or lower, he'll break his oath. And if I say, I swear by God, I will not speak to your cousin, well, that's not a good example. No. No, it's not a good example. Because you cannot divide them into two and say, this is cousin. Which one are you talking about? I'm sorry.
If you say, for example, they cannot speak more than one of them, doesn't contribute to this conclusion.
Yeah.
If they cannot speak any of them,
then you have to adjust this maximum. Yeah, that's my point. That they took both of them, they took the first one and said this, and then they took the second one and said, well, this is the maxim, but we have to adjust.
What would be an example of negation?
Yeah, if he talks to either lower Mawali or upper Mawali, he talks to them. He broke his oath. Yeah, I'm saying that Abu Hanifa said...
Can you add negation to example to make it
clear? Yeah, this is what he's saying, that I will not speak to any of them. That's negation. I mean, he said, I will not speak to his Mawali. The negation means that when you say Mawali, you mean any of his Mawali. Okay, in other words, if he said, I will speak to his Mawali, and he did not define which one, upper or lower Mawali, will not judge it the same way. If he says, I will speak to his Mawali. Brothers, just a second, please. If he says, I will speak to his Mawali, just the opposite now, it's not. He says, by Allah, I will speak to his Mawali, not using negation, and he speaks to the upper Mawali, we cannot say that he has fulfilled his vow. Because we don't know whether he was referring to the upper or lower. So therefore we will say that we don't know if he fulfilled his vow. Okay, this list that I just I didn't pass out actually. It was passed out. By the way, they just named the books, that's why I didn't translate them into English. Okay, this is if you're so interested by this class. If you're so excited by this class. Okay. Here are the basic books. Here are the basic books of Usul al-Fiqh. Okay? Starting with the books of the Mutakallimun. Okay? You see Risale by Imam Shafi. Okay. If you go down to Al-Mughni fi Abwab al-Adl wa Tawheed. Anytime you see Adl wa Tawheed in the title, this means the author must be what? Huh? He must be Mu'tazil. Anytime you see Adl wa Tawheed, means he's Mu'tazil. They call themselves Ahl Adl wa Tawheed. Okay, in the 17th volume of that work, he has a work on, the 17th volume is devoted, books of Mutakallimun, this one. 17th volume of that work is devoted to Usul al-Fiqh. The rest is, to the Mu'tazil. No, of course not. Okay. Now he has another book called Al-Umad. I forgot to put it down. Okay. Al-Umad. And then you have the next one. Abu Hussein al-Basri is also Mu'tazili. His book Al-Mu'tamad fi Usul al-Fiqh. These are going in, by the way, time. The first real book on Usul al-Fiqh from the Hanbali point of view was Al-Udda fi Usul al-Fiqh. Until recently there was a copy of that available in the Jeddah airport. After Abu Ya'la and Al-Udda fi Usul al-Fiqh came Ibn Qudama and Ibn Taymiyyah. These are the three, and the family of Ibn Taymiyyah, these are the three basic Hanbali references. You see Al-Udda fi Usul al-Fiqh. That is the first and the basic Hanbali Salafi reference. Because in the introductory section, he refutes some of the views of the Sha'ira. Okay. Next comes Al-Burhan fi Usul al-Fiqh. Okay. The next one, Al-Luma fi Usul al-Fiqh. I brought it the last 2 days, you know, to show you this is it. And now I forgot, of course, the one day we finally get around to this. Okay. And the next one finally is Al-Ghazali al-Mustasra. If you take the four, Al-Umd, Al-Mu'tamid, and Al-Burhan, and Al-Mustasra, these are known as the four classic works. Okay. These are known as the four classic works. If you want to study Usul al-Fiqh, you should study these four. Al-Umd, which is not there, by Al-Qadi Abdul Jabbar, where it says, Al-Mughni fi Abwab al-Adl wa Tawheed. No. And Al-Mu'tamid fi Usul al-Fiqh by Abu Hussein al-Basri. And Al-Burhan fi Usul al-Fiqh by Imam al-Haramain al-Juwayni. Wal al-Mustasra, three down, by Abu Hamid al-Ghazali. These are the big four. Just like General Motors, Chrysler, Ford, and American Motors. Okay? American Motors, I guess, is no longer around. Risala is from the early, and all of these actually are kind of growing out of the Risala. Now, the next one you'll see is Al-Mahsul fi Ilm al-Usul by Fakhruddin al-Razi. He combined these four. Okay, he went to these four and he tried to combine them as much as possible, and he tried to include as much evidence as possible. And it is a very good edition of that from Khamis Mukhtasar. Yeah. If you see Sheen, this means Sharh. Kha is Mukhtar. I would give you one in Indonesian, but I don't know what books Usul al-Fiqh they have in Indonesian. Okay. So Al-Mahsul, and there's a very good edition of it from Jamaat al-Imam, he took the four works and he kind of put them all into one. And there's many Mukhtasars of it because it's quite large. The same thing Al-Ahkam fi Usul al-Ahkam by Al-Amidi, he did the same thing. He took the big four, okay, and he put them in the one work, but much without the detail that the Razi had. Okay. We go to the books of the Fuqaha on the next page. Yes.
العلم
في أصول الفقه. العلم في أصول الفقه. أصل قضية جبر. هل أنت علم؟ Okay. Now the books of the Fuqaha. If there's any misspelled word, please excuse me. أصول الكرخي. This is the first one, basically. Basically, he's responding to Imam Shafi and trying to show what is the. So this is like 50 or 40 qawaid. It is famous for one statement, and Usul al-Kharhi will go down in history because of one statement. No, Hanafi. Books of the Fuqaha. That means these are all Hanafi. He is famous for one of his qawaid, which, if you think of their madhab, it makes sense. Any verse in the Quran or any hadith that goes against our madhab must be either mansukh or mutawwil. And it must be either abrogated or it's to be interpreted in such a way to fit our madhab. And if you think, if you look at the way of reasoning of the Fuqaha or the Hanafis, it makes sense. And because they're starting with fiqh, the best one of theirs is the one by known as Usul al-Bazdawi, and it has a commentary Kashf al-Asrar by Abdulaziz al-Bukhari. If you ever see it, buy two copies, one for you and one for me, and send it to me. all of you, huh? Sharh, Kashf al-Asrar, and it's sold with the Sharh, I think. The one by Al-Fusul fil Usul by Abu Bakr al-Razi al-Jassas. He has a very good reputation of Imam Shafi when it comes to, for example, Al-Istihsan. Then there came the next generation of books in which they tried to combine the two approaches. How do you combine these two approaches? No, yani these people are starting with the theory, and basically they only refer to actual fiqh points as examples. So what the next generation tried to do is to take this theory and on every point try to relate it to a fifth point. Okay? Get my drift?
They didn't start with conclusions.
Now they start with the theory and they try to go all the way down to what the Fuqaha were doing. Okay? The most important of those are the ones by Taftazani and the one by Subki, Jamal Jawami. He claims that Jamal Jawami is based on 100 books. And he, a good one also is Musallam al-Thabut, near the bottom. It is published on the margin of al-Mustasfa by...
These are the numbers of the
dates. Yeah, the dates after their names are the dates that they died. Okay, the next... kind, extracting the practical points from the maxim Tukhrij al-Furwa, obviously, al-Usul. This is a very interesting topic. They tried to take all of the qawaid and show how they're applied in fiqh. Okay. To give an example from Dabus's book, Ta'asis al-Nadr. Ta'asis al-Nadr is basically describing where the Hanafis and the Shafis disagree. Okay? And actually, it's closer to fiqh than usul fiqh. But one of the, as most of the Hanafi books are, one of the asl or one of the principles that he has, the Hanafis say that the salat of the follower is related or connected to the prayer of the Imam. Okay? The Shafis say no. Okay, based on this asl, here are some of the principles that that we get from it. This is from Ta'asis al-Nadr at the Busi. The Hanafi said that if the Imam prays while he was not ala tahara, he was not pure, and the follower did not know it, both the prayer of the Imam and the follower is not valid. Not valid, but it is both. This is Hanafi. Because the Hanafi say, it's based on this principle, the Hanafi say that the salat of the follower is connected or related to the Salat of the Imam. Shafi'i say no. The Hanafis say that if the Imam was supposed to make sajda sahu, or the sajda for forgetfulness, but he forgot, okay, he's supposed to make sajda sahu and he forgot, then the followers are not supposed to make it either. Because yani, their prayer is supposed to follow the Imam. Shafi'i says, yes, if you're a follower, even if the Imam forgets, you should make sajda sahu. That's when the Imam makes a mistake. Hanafis say no. Hanafis say that if the man leaves the prayer behind, if a man is praying behind the Imam and he leaves the prayer and prays by himself, his salat is batil. Shafi'i say no.
What do you mean by this?
And if, for example, during the time of the Prophet ﷺ, the Imam was making the salat very long, so one person left and he prayed by himself. Well, the Prophet ﷺ did not tell him to repeat his prayer. But because of this asal that the Hanafis have, they said, no, his prayer is not batil. The Hanafis say, for example, that if someone is praying Dhuhr, he cannot pray behind the Imam who is praying Asr. Shafi'i say, yes, he may. Hanafis say that if someone is praying Wajib, one of the Wajib Salawat, he cannot pray behind someone who is praying Nafila. Shafi'i say, okay. And this kind of book, Takhrij al-Furu' al-Usul. And we begin late. Anytime we begin late, this is like injury time and soccer. I'm the only one who knows. We're in the actual transition. Now, a different approach, let me just talk about Imam Shatibi's work for a few brief moments. As I said, there's a PhD dissertation written in English that is on reserve in the library about Shatibi's book on Muwafaqat. Basically, his argument is this, said that ijtihad, or yani, making rulings for the Sharia, are based on two principles. The Arabic language and the type of stuff that Imam Shafi wrote about. Okay? This is not what al-Muwafaqat is about. Yani that stuff is already discussed. And al-Maqasid al-Sharia, or the goals of the Sharia. That when you make... when you make ijtihad, he says you must know these principles, and at the same time you must also understand the Maqasid al-Sharia. It is a unique work. In the history of Islam, there's no other work similar to it. Dahlawi's work is somewhat, but this is the only work. It is four volumes, and I'll make a commercial for Muhammad Dweb in Fort Collins. He has it for sale there. Well, we'll end with that. We finally got to the handout.